This is a Renewed Covenant Ministry message. Every message delivered by this ministry strives to show the relevance of the most important covenant ever revealed to God's people, the New Covenant, a covenant offering grace through faith, thereby renewing the law of God in our hearts and minds through the manifestation of the only begotten Son and eternal Word of God, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Son of God and Son of Man, the firstborn among many brethren. The majority of our audio messages come from our Sabbath Bible studies, delivered by Brother J.S. Lowther at a Sabbath convocation centered around the patriarchal family structure near Marietta, Ohio. Contact us by mail at Box 134, 140 Gross Street, Marietta, Ohio, 45750. Find related messages relevant to the systematic theology offered by Renewed Covenant Ministry at renewedcovenantministry.com. And now for the message.
Well, we are going to focus on the second part of an introduction to brotherhood and brotherly love, which is what this particular small series just last and today, and then I'm going to continue with it later on, maybe in a month or so. And it's coming from a focal text from Proverbs 17 through 18. So let's hear the words of the Lord that were penned by Solomon, the son of David, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A man void of understanding striketh hands and becometh surety in the presence of his friend. Let's hear end in the reading of God's holy word, as it has been written to us. The ESV translation I read to you last time says, one who lacks sense gives a pledge and puts up security in the presence of his neighbor. And I think last week, I worked to show the origins of brotherhood, as that is what this text is dealing with. And I want to give some application before I go on any further in studying this subject, because I showed that it stems from family and from the family to the kindred. That's the next step out. That's kind of like your immediate family. So you got your brothers, sisters, father, mother, cousins, uncles, and all that kind of thing. So that's your kindred. And then from the kindred, we move out into this thing called a tribe biblically. And the tribe is an even greater measure of the family. And then after that, of course, after those three, we become involved with the nation or the ethnic people of the tribe the tribes are all connected to. And then after that, you have a race. And so that is kind of the outspreading of brotherhood, okay, as God talks about it in his word. It's nothing foreign to the Bible. It may be foreign to modern day Christianity, but it's not foreign to the Bible. It's a very common thing in the Bible. And I'm hoping that in connection to last week's resuscitational reading of Deuteronomy 15, I don't know if we remember that, which we read in Deuteronomy 15, that we will also then consider after this Leviticus chapter 25, which we will look at in detail first, and then we'll go through it afterwards. And consider all of these implications on brotherhood and on brotherly love and how they interact one with the other. I want to read the proverb from 17 through 18 out of another translation of the Holy Scriptures. It is the Septuagint translation. It's the oldest translation of the Scriptures from Hebrew into Greek of the Old Testament and the Apocrypha. And so it makes it was actually more quoted by the apostles in the New Testament than it was by than the Hebrew was translated into a new Greek form. So it's important to kind of see how it says things because it does help our thinking. This is how it says it in the Brenton Septuagint, Proverbs 17:17 through 18. Have thou a friend for every time, and let brethren be useful in distress, for on this account are they born. A foolish man applauds and rejoices over himself, and he also that becomes surety would make himself responsible for his own friends. The ABP, which is another Septuagint translation of verse 18, says, a foolish man claps and rejoices over himself, as also the one guaranteeing a loan for surety for his own friend. Both of them are accurate translations, as is the King James Version, but they give different ways of considering what's being said. And so here's the reason for this focal text. Somebody might at this point say, well, what's this proverb even have to do with brotherhood and brotherly love? And I think that's a good question in our day and age. And the reason for that is because biblical law is not our culture anymore. Okay? It was much more our culture a few hundred years ago than it is today. But now we've totally neglected what the Bible says and therefore don't understand what this is about. So this proverb makes no sense today. That's just the unfortunate truth of the vast majority of the world. And so that prayer, open thou mine eyes that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law, is very applicable in texts like this because we don't know what it means. Friends are another good thing to talk about in talking about brethren. And so the first question you'd have to ask in this proverb is, well, what's the correspondence of friends and brothers? Why are they both mentioned? A friend in the Hebrew is a Ria. Ria is the Hebrew word for friend or neighbor. It's also translated throughout the Bible. And in tribal Israel, it indicated a relationship starting at your closest relatives, your closest people living to you as your neighbor, the people you're around the most, especially with no cars and only having horses and such, were the people you were closest related to because the land was settled in lots by tribe. So this isn't really expressing a whole new concept, but it is going outside of your closest relatives. It's moving itself away. It's saying, okay, not your brothers, but the people closest to you are the ones that you should be loving as yourself. So not to say you don't love your brothers as yourself, because we read that also in the New Testament, where the word brother and the word neighbor are switched out for one another. And so there's no huge difference between the two. But anyone can be your friend is the point, or anyone can be your neighbor. But you can only expect to trust your friend so much, is kind of the point that's being talked about. You can only expect to trust a friend so much. While your brother, who is your immediate family, he has a lawful obligation. The closer he is in kinship to you, he has a lawful obligation, a right, so to speak. You have a right to expect out of your brother some form of security from him that you don't expect out of your friend. Your friend does it out of love. Where your brother in biblical law had to take care of you. It was part of his responsibility under God, and that's gone. Our society does not think that way. We all think like friends, and we all generally think like friends who have a choice whether we can love or not, or if whether we want to or we don't. And so God says here that it is a favor that he has placed upon a person to give them a brother simply by their birth for adversity or distress. That's how things are to be. It's not how they are. It's how they are to be, and that's how they should be among Christian families for sure. And Christians with one another. And so when you have friends who love for every time, and you have brethren who love with brotherly love, who have been given to a man for times of adversity, for times of struggle in life, you have security, like is spoken of in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 15. You have security in the social order, that is. You have a sense of social order, and that is a godly sense of order, and it's a good foundation. It's the thing we should have. We're to go to Proverbs chapter 3. I want to elaborate on this concept a little bit from another proverb that does a really good job speaking about it. Proverbs chapter 3, starting in verse 27. And while I'm not going to read prior to it, because you can just keep going with stuff like this, it comes right on the heels of talking about godly wisdom. Okay? It's right on the heels of talking about how godly wisdom founded the world, and it's the best thing for you to do is to walk in godly wisdom. That's basically, there's the nutshell version of Proverbs chapter 3. And then immediately after that, what we are talking about now is brought into perspective by the wisdom of Solomon. Verse 27 says of Proverbs 3, withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of thine hand to do it. Say not to your neighbor, go and come again, and tomorrow I will give you, when thou hast it by thee. And so let me stop for a moment. He's saying you got what you need to pay the man back. You can pay your debt off, but you choose not to. So then, immediately after that portion of godly wisdom, he says in 29, devise not evil against your neighbor. Seeing he dwells securely by you, he's safe. In other words, if you do what's spoken of in these two verses against your own neighbor, your own brethren, you will cause insecurity. Something's going to happen. Evil is going to happen. Okay? And so then 30 says, strive not with a man without cause. So now it's looked at as if this is fighting without a cause. That's what it's. That's how God looks at it. It's like fighting without a cause, to not pay a man what he's due. And choose none of his ways. I'm sorry, I skipped one. If he has done thee no harm. Envy thou not the oppressor, and choose none of his ways. And so, in other words, you're being compared to an oppressor. So we have to find out what that is. We'll do that in a moment. And do not choose his ways. That's either side. That's either the side in which you are being oppressed or you have chosen to be oppressed. That can go in both directions. 32, for the froward is abomination. That means the crooked, by the way. The crooked man is an abomination to Yahweh, to the Lord. But his secret, Yahweh's secret, is with the righteous. The reason why 32 says it the way he does is because it seems like a good idea to withhold to him, if you can, what is due to the natural man. It seems like the right option. Hey, I get to keep my money. Maybe he'll die tomorrow. I want to pay him back. Who knows? You don't know what the thought is there. But there are wicked intentions, froward intentions, crooked intentions that men would have. But what God says is this will cause insecurity in the neighborhood, in the brotherhood, in the society, in the social order, if you do this. Okay? If you don't deal with one another as brethren. And so here's the problem in our society today, quite frankly, between these two proverbs. We have a good look at our problems in comparing them to what the law of God says. We've forsaken God. We've forsaken the wisdom of God as it is taught in his word, as it is taught in his law. And we have forsaken our own brotherhood and our own social order as God ordained it. And as our ancestors had just not too long ago, it's not been long forgotten, but it is quickly going down the drain. Because society will not listen to the laws of God. They will not prefer the laws of God, and therefore we are not secure. And we're not secure because of our practices like this, ones that show that we do not love our brother and our neighbors as ourselves. We do not have brotherly love amidst us because we are not a brotherhood. And really, if you just kind of meditate on that in and of itself and watch the news or listen to the news or something like that, you'll realize that that is the problem. That's our problem in society. Not how we deal with the stranger, but how brothers interact with one another. How to deal with strangers comes later. We care not for the security of our brother, is the point. He should be our friend. He should be our neighbor. But we don't love him as ourselves. We won't treat him in the way that he should be treated. And we don't do that in our country today because we are not a nation of brothers. That's just a sad reality. Therefore, the strange ways of insecurity have come into us. They have caused us to desire the ways of the oppressor, which is the way of the usurer and the loan giver. And we choose his ways, and we become froward and crooked, and we have forsaken the secret of security because it is with the Lord. And it is taught in his law, and we will not go to his law to learn it. So what says the cultural and lawful wisdom of the law of God? Well, the cultural and lawful wisdom of the law of God says, have thou a friend for every time. It's good to have friends. It's good to have bunches of friends. It's good to have the love of friends. It's good to love your friends and your neighbors as yourselves. But let brethren be useful in distress. Brethren should be useful in distress. For this account, God says, they were born, they were generated, they were made. A foolish man applauds and rejoices over himself. Oh, I can do it all by myself. Even though his friend will become surety in the loan that he makes, and he'll become responsible for that friend who rejoices over himself. You know, I've always found it fascinating that people, when they buy a house on a bank loan, always say, I bought the house, or I bought the farm, or I bought this, or I bought that. They haven't, though. The bank bought it for them. They rejoice in themselves. The foolish man applauds and rejoices over himself, but he doesn't really own it. That's just the sad reality of it. And that's how we think today. We think contrary to the laws of God. And so in biblical law, a brother is born for distress, however. That is, in times past, you would go to your biological, genetic, familial, tribal, ethnic, whatever you want to call it, relatives, in order to get you out of distress. And our minds always go to the Great Depression when we think about things like that. Because that was a time when people in distress had to cling to their brothers because the government failed them and the social order that was there fell apart totally. So people had each other. That's what you had. Neighbors and friends loved one another, and families took care of each other. They had to. They fell right back into the intrinsic law of God. They had to. There was no other option. And so I think that that's a very important thing to consider. And for whatever reason, God has chosen an economic way to show us in our mind's eye, how we are brotherhood or how we are not, how we are loving each other or how we are not, or how we applaud ourselves or how we don't. If we were to go to Leviticus 25, I'll show you some of the words we've already covered in these Proverbs to elaborate this before we move on into the text. Leviticus 25:35. I would say if you were to look at this all over verse 43, you would see this as the maxim. This is the major point of this. Thou shalt not rule over him, your brother, that is, with rigor, but you shall fear God. That's the maxim. Do not rule over one another with rigor, and rigor gets defined by God. Leviticus chapter 25:35 says, if your brother be waxen poor and he has fallen in decay, that means he's in distress or adversity with thee, you shall relieve him, yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner. Now, that literally means a traveler from another tribe, okay? It's not talking about a total stranger to the brotherhood, or else he wouldn't be a brother. And so it's talking about a traveler from another tribe, that he may live with thee. Live with thee. Take thou no usury. Now, there's a word we don't use in English. It means loans. Take no loan of him. Or increase from him. In other words, make money off giving him a loan. But fear your God, that your brother may live with thee. He could have said, live securely by thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals, that's your food, for increase. I am Yahweh your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And then he adds this, and if your brother that dwell by thee wax poor. So we were told in Deuteronomy 15, the poor will always be among us. If he wax poor, if he is sold unto thee, so that means you literally purchase him. You have to pay something for him. Thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant. He's not the same. Here's why. As a hired servant, as a sojourner, as a traveler, he is with you. And he will serve you only to the year of Jubilee. So there was a certain time every 7 years that a man was to be released, and every 50 years, men were to go back to their own tribe, to their own neighborhood, so to speak. Okay? That's how God's social order was conducted among brethren. 41 then says, and then shall he depart from thee, both he and his children with him, and return to his own family, unto his own family, unto his own family, unto the possession of his fathers shall he return. For they are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as bondmen. Thou shalt not rule over him with rigor, but shall fear thy God. Now, if you were to go back and you were to consider what else is said in the book of Leviticus, as we'll discuss in more detail at a future point, it specifically told us in both Deuteronomy 15 and in these texts, that a stranger, one who is not of the brethren, is to be allowed to be purchased and to be bonded to a family, so much so that they can be inherited by your children and your children's children. That's the law of God. That's how it is. People who are not related to that people, that's how it worked. But it worked in a way to keep people thinking about who they were as a brotherhood. In other words, like I was explaining to Marie this morning about a totally different subject, if it were not for the opposite, you would oftentimes not understand the focus. If you didn't understand vessels of wrath, that there are things that are broken, there's broken pots, You would never understand a perfect pot. If all pots leaked out water when you put water in it, then that would be what the pot was. But since there are pots that hold water and they're pretty and perfect and they're well made, then you understand the broken pot is broken. Without that opposition, you don't have anything. You have nothing to consider. And in this case, without strangers, you don't understand a brotherhood. And without a brotherhood, you don't understand strangers. That's just the way it works. And so, according to the Bible, the fear of God is to prefer your brother and your brotherhood that God has made you part of over others, and not oppress one another, but to love them in preference and in order. Okay? This isn't to say that you rule over rigor with the stranger, or you oppress the stranger, because that's forbidden too in the scriptures. To oppress anybody who's not of the brethren is forbidden in the Bible as well. But if you want security among the nation, if you want security among the kindred, if you want security among the tribe or the state, if you want security among the township or the kindred, you have to love one another as yourselves. You have to be a true brotherhood. There's no security when people will not deal justly with one another. But if they deal with one another as strangers, it breeds problems. Okay? Everyone becomes strange, and then insecurity becomes the normal. Brothers are rather born for distress. Brothers are born for adversity. That's why God has given them. Matter of fact, in the Septuagint, when I looked up the word on this account, it actually was the word for grace. Brothers are the grace for adversity. That's what it says. God gives by his grace family, brotherhood. He also gives by his grace faith. And so in order to understand brotherhood and brotherly love, corresponding one with one another, you have to have a proper concept of God's law. Without it, there is no direction in which a society has to go in what is right or wrong. And you can listen to the news and think that because people prefer their brethren, they are haters and racist and destructive to this global ideal. You could believe that that was so. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible teaches that a brotherhood's a good thing. It's made for adversity. Okay? And friendship is made to love one another. That's why it's made. So friends, neighbors, and brethren all have their purpose. There are certain purposes with right, and there are certain purposes with privilege. Okay? No one can cause another person to love you as a friend. It just can't be done. But a brother has a certain obligation. It is your right to expect that your brother will be there for you when you're down. We do not live in a way where this extension in Leviticus 25 is followed, however. We cannot any more expect that just because we are of the same nation or race as another person, that they have their preference towards us and we have their preference towards them. That is evil now. We live in a world where that has become evil. But the Bible doesn't teach it that way. And it's very obvious the Bible doesn't teach it. It does not teach the oppression of the stranger, but it also teaches the preference of the brotherhood. That's just the way it works. And unless we think about it in this way, in reality, we're never going to see social order be healed. It's only going to get worse. And so long as that is what is in the minds of people, it's going to happen that way. They will become the head. We will become the tail. The old nation will fall away, and something new will replace it, and it's only going to be chaos that can be managed by somebody who knows better. That's just what's going to happen. You must have certain tensions to control people, and these are the tensions that someone has chosen to control the nation we live in today, and it is the one that was always used, as I pointed out in our last week's Bible study, that the kings of Assyria and Babylon always used when they conquered the nation of Israel. They put new people in that land, took them people and put them in that land, mixed everything up so you can control them better. Because why then you have to depend on the government? That's just the truth of it. And it's not a government that's built to prefer the family. It's a government that's made to prefer itself. It's a selfish government. And so that's kind of the whole purpose of my thoughts here. And so I'm going to go over... Somebody's phone needs turned off. I want to go back over some of the things that we talked about last week, and then I want to add a few things to them. If you recall, I pointed out the Genesis 4:26 where it said Seth had a son born to him. His name was Enos, and it was on that day. It was at that time men began to call upon the name of Yahweh together. And I pointed out that this was the first formation of a brotherhood in a church, and that the word church was the word for the calling out, the calling of the people together, but the people called out unto the Lord to come to him and to worship him. And then I also pointed out that in Romans chapter 10, we saw a scripture that said, whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And so if we put those two concepts together, it's very obvious that the men in Enos' day, they came together for salvation, security, that is. It's not a foreign concept. They needed security, and what they did was come into a church structure. They came together to call upon the name of the Lord to be saved, physically and spiritually. Men came together, and I pointed out also that this was something not uncommon to our ancestors. The Puritans are a great example in America, as well as the Anabaptists, in my opinion. I don't agree with their theology, but the Anabaptists know how to come together and be a people in a brotherhood, that's for sure. And we have, by and large, lost that. I've also made a point that most likely the salvation the people needed physically was probably to get away from the people of Cain, so they could get away from those who prefer what they want and how they want to live over the ways of God, because those people rise up and kill their brothers because they have no brotherly love, they have no peace, they have no joy, and what they want is what they want, and that will drive them to kill you if you've got what they want. And so security and calling on the name of the Lord is a governmental action. In a sense, if you don't do it under God's ways, by God's law, then you're going to have something else, and it's going to look more like the ways of Cain. And so that was one of the reasons I used that to point it out. And I want that to be connected to what we're talking about in the preference of a brotherhood and why that's the case. I also pointed out that in the times of Enos, we could probably place Enos as being the preacher, so to speak. He was the one who it's mentioned as having, he's the tribal head, so to speak, of Adam's people at that time. And that just like we see all throughout the Bible, as it stems from Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, that says that prophets are to come from their own brethren, that was the order that was even being set as far back as Genesis chapter 4. I also use the elders of Israel to show how this brotherhood was to be maintained. That was that there were older men, who were to be used. These are family men who had certain qualities about them of faith, right? And so the leader, the prophet, the preacher, the teacher, whatever the person is, and then the elder, who is the real tribal head, he actually is a family man. He's actually the type of person that can lead a family, is also placed in some way over the church, the people who come together to call out. And he does so because he is, number one, a wise man. He's a man of understanding. He's known among his tribe. So he's known among his people. He is part of the tribe. He was made ruler then over his brethren, it's called. And he is provided out of that tribe himself. He's an able man, it says. He is able to fear God, and he fears God. He is a man of truth. He hates covetousness. He doesn't just kind of sort of dislike it. He hates covetousness. And those are the requirements of faith that will maintain brotherly love in a society for the brotherhood. Okay, it was out of them there were to be rulers over small groups, 10, and then a larger group, 50, and then another group of 100, and then another group of 1,000. And that was to build up into a tribe. These were to be the judges, Exodus 18:22 says. That was to be the way it was in God's kingdom of Israel. And so, in reality, that's exactly what it should be among us today. That's what should be being strived for, but we're very, very far from it. As a matter of fact, it seems as if you hate truth and if you prefer covetousness, you probably could become a politician and get in office today. That's about where we're at. So the complete opposite. Men want to rule the whole nation. They don't want small rulers of 10, 50, hundreds, and thousands where you have some form of local brotherhood independence. Rather, they want to govern the entirety of the USSA. So that's just kind of the way it is right now. That's the direction we're going. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to point out these things. It's one of the reasons I want to consider both the spiritual need for brotherly love but the physical need for a brotherhood and how the two have to act together, because that's what the Bible consistently shows. I want to talk about a few other consistencies and then get into a little bit more of the dealings with one another. There was a time in Numbers chapter 18 that God knew was going to take place. We're to go to Numbers 18, verse 1, where God knows that Israel is going to want a king, a federal leader, one that all the elders of the tribes can come to and get judgment and seek advice like all the other nations. And there's lots of thoughts on this. But there was also a need prior to that for a priesthood of the federal people as well. So there's two elements I want to talk about, one out of Numbers 18 and another one out of Deuteronomy chapter 17. And there are two federal situations that occur in the Bible. And so there's eventually a place where God says there's a need for a priesthood federally, and there was a need for a kingship federally. And he knew that was going to arise among the people, and so he puts rules around it. And so the first thing I want to start out is first the priesthood, and then I want to talk about the kingship. It's commonly believed, because it's seen in Scripture, that from Noah onward, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are executing a priest's office. We see them offering sacrifices and things like that. And so people prefer that that is probably part of the right of the firstborn, or part of a right that was given from father to son in some capacity prior to the ordination of Levi and Aaron's sons. But there is a time in the time of Exodus where a perpetual, that means everlasting covenant, is given to the tribe of Levi in the nation of Israel to be priests. And so in this federal capacity, where all the tribes answer to it, so to speak, in certain capacities, this is what God says. He says in Numbers 18:1, "And Yahweh said to Aaron, thou and thy sons and thy father's house with thee shall bear the iniquity of the sanctuary, and thou and thy sons with thee shall bear the iniquity of your priesthood. And thy brethren also of the tribe of Levi, the tribe of thy father, bring thou with thee, and they may be joined unto thee and minister unto thee, but thou and thy sons with thee shall minister before the tabernacle of witnesses." I'm going to jump down to verse 6. It says, "And I, the Lord, behold, I have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the children of Israel. To you they are given as a gift for the Lord, to do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. Therefore, thou and thy sons with thee shall keep your priest's office for everything of the altar within the veil, and ye shall serve. I have given you your priest's office unto you to serve, and to give gifts." And then listen to what he says in verse 7. He says, "And the stranger that comes nigh shall be put to death." In other words, nobody but the Levites were allowed to come to the altar. None. Not even another tribe of Israel. None. The stranger that came nigh was to be put to death. So there's a closeness in the tribe of Levi. God appointed this federal office of priest, and then he says, "You alone, and in this way, have these charges. These are yours. They're no one else's. This is who I give it to. No one else can take it. No one can approach it. Anyone who approaches it dies," under Moses' law. And so the priesthood was only given to one tribe of the children of a nation of 12 or 13 sons. And anyone strange to that tribe's family who come near to that office were to be put to death. And so not even Moses' sons could do the jobs of Aaron's sons. There were two Levitical families of note, Moses' sons and Aaron's sons. Well, Aaron's sons were the priests. Moses' were not priests in the same way. And so if one came and tried to do the other's job, it was not permitted. So when a person tried to approach to take those particular jobs, they were usurpers, and it was punished by death. That's just the way it is. There's other rules on the priesthood also. These are common rules in the greater extent of the Israelite people. That is how the Israelite was to marry and how other peoples were to marry. But in the priests, it was even more strict. It says this in Leviticus 21:13. It says, "He shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman, or profane or a harlot. These shall he not take, but he shall take a virgin of his own people to wife. Neither shall he profane his seed among his people, for I, Yahweh, do sanctify him," or make him holy. In other words, a priest was allowed to marry of the sons of Israel, of the Israelite women, and if he did not, he would profane his seed, is what it says. "Neither shall he profane his seed among his people." He was not allowed to take a wife who was not an Israelite or a wife who breaks any of these other rules. That's just the way it was. So there was an even more strict law for the priest. As we find in Israel, men were able to marry Midianites, and you have other people who are married into the Israelite people that are of permissible stock, while you have others that are said they can't be married. And God says you can't marry those of another race. And so in the Levite situation, he was even more constrained. He was not allowed to marry anybody but a daughter of Israel. Okay? And so there's certain rules that are set on the priesthood, on the federal level, to be an example to all the people when they needed one. What about the king? What about the other federal office that I want to focus on today? Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 15, starts talking about that day when Israel chose a king, to have a king. God knew it was going to happen, therefore it was written in the law of God. Here is the rules. So you have to realize that hundreds of years before Saul and David were made kings of Israel, that this law was written on the books. So sometimes you have to ask yourself, where did they get the idea? I think that's an interesting thing to consider. So here's some of the parameters placed on the king in verse 15. "Thou shalt," and well, it's actually placed on the people. Let me take that back. This is placed upon the people. So the elders of Israel, the tribes, the people, would actually make sure the government did the right thing. So you have a situation of lex rex, the law above the king, not prex lex, the king above the law. "Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom Yahweh thy God shall choose." And here's how he chooses. Here's how God chooses. "One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. You may not set a stranger over thee, which is not of thy brother." So let's just stop for a moment. The very first thing God says is, number one, I'm going to choose him. Number two, in that choice, don't even think for a moment that a foreign ruler is the one that I want you to have. Don't even think for a moment someone not of the brotherhood of the Israelite people is the proper ruler for your country, because it's not. We have a brotherhood here. The law is based on brotherhood. It's not based on anything else. And so once again, one more time, God puts it out there. Even in the federal level, make sure this is followed. And then here's some rules for the government. "He shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt," which is a euphemism for slavery. "He shall not multiply horses to himself," means he's not allowed to become rich. "To the end that he should multiply horses." I just do it to do it. Get rich to get rich. "For as much as the Lord has said to you, you shall henceforth return no more that way," meaning to the way of Egypt. You should not rule over each other with rigor, is what he's saying. King can't do it either. "Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. It shall be that when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write a copy of this law." I believe what it means is not just the whole book of Deuteronomy, which could be what it's referring to, but this law God wanted to make sure he wrote. "I will not multiply horses. I will not do this. I will not do that. I will write a copy of the law." That's what the king had to write. "I will not oppress my brethren. But when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he will write a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the Levites." So he answers to the other federal office. "And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law, and these statutes to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment, to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So the king, who God says, I know you're going to want, had to write a copy of God's law. He had to be bound to the law of God. The Levites, the priests before him, made sure that he wrote the copy of the law that was in the Bible, and it wasn't something he altered or changed due to his preferences. And the people assured that the priests did that. And then they sat him on the throne so he could rule justly among his brethren. And so what is the point here that I think needs to be made? Not that we should have a king. I'm not making that point for our government. But rather that a brotherhood is bound to the law of God in all regards. It has to be bound to the law of God. God's law has to be paramount in a nation. It has to be paramount in a kindred setting. It has to be paramount in a brotherhood. It has to be paramount among the church. If it is not, then we have no guidance and men make it up as they go. And they will multiply horses. They will multiply wives. They will get gold and silver. They will do what they should not, and they will oppress their brethren, and they will teach it to be done. Okay? You'll have a prosperity gospel like you've never heard of before. And that's pretty much what we're getting today. And so, I want to apply this to Deuteronomy 15 in exiting out of this Bible study as we think about it. I'm going to go back to Deuteronomy 15. I'm getting the books of the law all mixed up. Deuteronomy 15, 11 and 12, I just want to read. Now that we've covered the federal system, we've established it's still part of the brotherhood. We've established God only wanted it to be part of the brotherhood. And then he lays certain specific laws upon it and says, this is how it has to be done. Even the king's bound to the law. Even the priests are bound to the law. No one's above the law. Okay? That will maintain the brotherhood. All of it goes back to increase in economy. Time and again, it goes back to, this is your portion, priests. This is what you're given. You're given no more than that. Here's what I give you, and I give it to you, and it's special, and it's good for you, and this is what you should do. And then when he says, kings, here's what I give you. Here's what your job is. This is what you need to do. This is how you're going to maintain the brotherhood. All of it helps the brotherhood dwell securely by the law of God. Without the justice of the law of God, there is no security. And when the federal government takes that upon themselves and gets rid of the law of God, they take it and make the laws for themselves, they will destroy the security and make the people insecure. They will act as if they're strangers, not brethren. So back to Deuteronomy 15, 11 and 12, it says, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto your brother, to thy poor, to thy needy in thy land. I want to notice the thys. Thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, and to thy needy in thy land. Okay, specific language. 12 says, and if your brother, who's a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, be sold to thee and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall let him go free from thee. In other words, he's not to be a bondservant. So here's my point. From the poor to the king, one law. Okay? From the king to the poor, one law. The law of brotherhood and brotherly love. Okay? And it all comes out of the law of God. Justice always flows from the law of God. All right? And so again, Leviticus 25, 47. I want to show this in another way, in detailing what biblical brotherly love looked like to the Apostle Paul, Peter, John, James, Jesus, all the way back to Moses, all the way back to Noah, however far you want to go. These are the principles of brotherly love. You do not rule over others with rigor. How does that mean? Does it mean that you just give stuff away for free? Does it mean you just execute whatever is loving in your own heart? Do you define that for yourself? Leviticus 25:47 says, if a sojourner or stranger wax rich by thee, and thy brother that dwelleth by him wax poor, and sell himself unto the stranger or the sojourner by thee, or to the stock of the stranger's family, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brethren may redeem him. Either his uncle or his uncle's son may redeem him, or any that is nigh kin unto him of his family may redeem him, and if he is able, he may even redeem himself. And so here's the point. If somebody becomes rich who's of the strangers, and one of your brethren who are poor sell themselves to them, then that man has a right in that country of your land, of your brother, and of your kindred to be redeemed at any point in preference. In preference. He can even redeem his own self. If he has the money, he can buy himself. You can never say no. This does not apply to the stranger, on the other hand. This keeps everyone answering to the law of God for their justice. Keeps everyone answering to the law of God. I don't know if the guys listening in can hear me, but someone needs to turn their mute on. The point I'm trying to make is that when a stranger waxes rich among you, it still does not give him, by reason of his wealth, the ability to rule the brotherhood. Money does not make power. Instead, what we're supposed to find is that the stranger in a brotherhood is always the stranger, even if he's rich. And a brotherhood and a brother always has preference, even to redeem his own self. Even a poor brother who has nothing else but the law of God to defend him and a little bit of money to buy himself back can never be denied in a brotherhood, because the brotherhood will tell the stranger, you must let him go. He's part of us. We prefer him. That's not being mean to the stranger. It's keeping destruction to happen in the government at bay. Okay? It's the only way it can work, because God set it up that way. It's the only way it will work. We're not related in different ways for no reason. And so I want to just point this out in considering this. And I just want to make sure it's clear. Whenever it's not a hard concept. We have allowed ourselves to become manipulated, I think, from common sense. Against common sense, I should say. You know who's your closest relative to you. You know your brothers are closest, your father and your mother. We know that. And then we know we move out. And then we move out. And then we move out. Uncles and so on and so forth. To your kindred and to your tribe and to your people. Right? You just continue to move out. We understand this. This is a natural concept. And God's faith, in his word, says that's the right way to go. I made you guys that way. It's the way it's supposed to be. What we do not do is then say, well, we are going to reverse the order because we think it's oppression to prefer our brother. Because that is totally contrary to the laws of God. And it is oftentimes linked to, once again, economy, wealth. Usury is the thing that is given to us. Not paying back your brother or your neighbor when you can. All these things are indicating how we actually feel on the inside of us. The king is lifted up by purchasing horses and obtaining wealth and getting wives, right? Okay, so there's this economic element that always shows us where we are in our brotherhood, according to God. Every single thing we've read so far deals with some level of economy. How far are you willing to love your nation, your people, your brotherhood, in preference to yourself? And are you willing, then, is the question, how far on a limb are people willing to go out for the brotherhood? I don't think that we can truly even understand the spiritual meanings of these things as far as how a church brotherhood works until we understand the physical on this regard. Because God made the physical spiritually by his word, and then he endorsed it and said, this is the way it's supposed to be. Okay, this is how I prefer you to live. And so I'm just going to end off here with this concept, with these ideas, and I'm going to pick this back up at some point in the future. But I thought this would make a good just two-part introduction to the ideas of brotherhood and brotherly love as the Bible talks about them. And I know they're not popular. It's the most un-PC message probably going to be definitely delivered on a Thursday. So, let alone on a Sunday. But the point I'm trying to make is that if we don't do things God's way, if we don't go and ask God his ways and how to do things in a society, in a social order, especially in the church, at those who should be faithful to the word of God, then we can never expect society to change for the better. So rather than ranting and raving about all the bad things in the world that sinners do, because sinners sin, that's what they do. The wicked are wicked, that's what they are. Wickedness fall into wickedness, that's what David says in his proverb. And so we don't expect anything less, but Christians, the righteous, should be doing righteously. And we should have no fear in proclaiming very clear scripture that shows this is the way God made it. Our ancestors actually were right about this one. Okay, when they founded this country and they did it in preference for their brethren, they actually were right. We don't need to be ashamed of it in our day and age. We shouldn't be ashamed of preferring our family over some guy in Zimbabwe, all right? We shouldn't feel that way. We should feel accosted when the government prefers the Somalis over its native-born citizens. We should feel accosted, and I think people do. And so that's the application to the modern day that I want to point out. This is a normal and natural way that you feel. If you feel this way, it's a normal and natural way God has made it to be. And to push against these pricks is ideal. It's what God is preferring us to do. He wants us to get rid of these thorns and briars in our thinking. And so I think that's something that I just really want to kind of lay down, because I've been listening to a lot on social order lately. I've been considering what everyone's saying on the news and on the media, even the conservatives, and they're still not preaching this. They're not saying, let's go back to the way it was. Let's go back to the way the founders of this country, our Puritan ancestors, on a Christian basis, made things. Let's go there. Nobody wants to hear that. That's not PC. That's not good. That's because it's from the law of God. And so that's really the reason why I brought this little introduction, and I want to elaborate the law of God on the subject here in the future as we
continue. For a News Covenant Ministry.